Chapter 31, The Fat Man with the Artificial Hair. Adam Egget slams on the brake and the car screeches to a stop in front of the Ski Inn. The parking lot is empty. At the top of a hill, we can see the mansion that is home to the fat man with the artificial hair. "Behold the Salton Sea, boys," the barkeep says, as he wipes a perfectly clean glass behind the bar. 20 years ago, it seemed like a surefire bet. But look around. And know that nothing is certain. We looked out the window, out at the uncertainty of it all. The town looks torn to hell, with the young meth heads stumbling around and giggling and scratching at itches that never go away, and the old men, rum-drunk, driving golf carts aimlessly through the rubble. No one goes near the beach. The sand, beside the Salton Sea, cannot be seen. This is because it is covered a foot deep and the broken skeletons of dead fish. And the stench is everywhere. "What happened here, old man?" I asked. "What killed everything?"
"Salt."
"Listen, old man, you're not making any sense. And you're making Adam Egget nervous. I want to go home, Norm. I want to go to the Comedy Store and ask to get my job back."
"You see, boys, salt corrodes. It eats everything. Steel. Rock. The dreams of men. I've seen it with my own eyes, boys. Salt can even kill a sea and eat the fish that live there."
"But salt is what makes a sea."
"Too much salt," mutters the old man and walks away. "Too much salt."
And so Adam Egget and I walk, ankle deep in fish skeletons and sludge, up to the giant unfinished house on the hill, the house that contains my last hope in this cold, cold world. As I get close to the entrance, I see the biggest red Cadillac I've ever seen. It's a beautiful thing how big it is. And I understand how a real fat guy would want a big car like this. And it's the brightest red. But even this expensive, beautiful car is not immune to the salt. There is disintegration along the edges, where the salt has eaten away at the steel. I hear a noise. And there stands a boy who must be about 10 years old, holding a big gun. "What are you here for?" the boy asks. And I carefully recite the line Gabe gave me. "I am a desperate man, here to ask a favor." The boy leads us through the house and into a large room. The room is magnificent. Red marble floors, oversized chairs with gold inlay on the mahogany arms, immaculately clean. There are three well-dressed goons, the type who like to punch you in the stomach, and they stand behind us. In front of us is a large table where the fat man with the artificial hair is eating a meal.
"Sit down, boys," he invites us to the table with his meaty paw.
"Well, we don't want to disturb your meal."
"Would you care to join me? It's tilapia. I caught it only an hour ago."
"But the bartender said that the fish were all dead. He said the salt ate them."
"He spoke the truth. The salt ate every type of fish but one."
The fat man with the artificial hair picks up a piece of his fish with a fork.
"Only the tilapia survived. It takes much more than salt to kill a creature like the tilapia fish."
And the fat man with the artificial hair takes a salt shaker, twists off its top, and pours half of it in his mouth. I can hear the salt crunching like glass between his teeth. I look around and notice there aren't any drinks on the table.
"How much you boys need?"
"He needs nothing ever," I say, motioning to Adam Egget. "I need $1 million, and I only need it for a week. The reason is..."
"No," he interrupts without looking up. "It's none of my business. Carlos, get the man his $1 million. These are the terms. The first month is free. After that, I charge 1% per week."
"Hold on," I say. "That's $10,000 a week. That's pretty thick juice." "Yeah," says Adam Egget as he stands up. "That's horse shit. No deal, fat man." One of the goons quickly punches Adam Egget in the stomach, and he falls to the floor.
"Did he just call me fat?" the fat man with the artificial hair asks.
And the hurt in his voice surprises me. Adam Egget is doing his best to apologize, but he can't get a sentence out proper
because he's still recovering from the massive blows. Sorry if I was out of line. Oh! Ah! Ah! With that crack about, oh! Ah! That sort of thing. It'd be sad to watch if it wasn't so funny. So let me understand. You think that $10,000 a week is too much to pay me if you lose the million? Yes, Hadamiga gasps from the floor. Yes, I think that is too much. Let me ask you something, boys. Are you planning to lose this $1 million I am loaning you? Is this what I am hearing from you? Oh, no, sir, I say. No, not at all. I have a plan, sir, and it's not to lose. It's to win and to pay you back quickly, taking advantage of your generous first-month free deal. Carlos enters the room with a duffel bag, and I can tell by the way he walks that that duffel bag is heavy, $1 million heavy. Sign this paper, says the fat man with the artificial hair. This catches me off guard, and I laugh. Here we are with two goons standing by Adam Egan, another with a red duffel bag full of money, and the fat man with the artificial hair is acting like we're in a legitimate bank doing legitimate business. But I don't care. I'll sign anything. My name is as worthless as a bent penny, and if it helps me to scribble it on a piece of paper, no problem. But when I look down at the document on the table, I understand. It's a life insurance policy he wants me to sign. It will, upon my passing, pay $2 million to my beneficiary. And across the table from me, smiling like a crocodile with salt-cake teeth and handing me a pen, sits my beneficiary. It came to me in a dream, he says. I smile right back at him and sign the paper.
A piece of coal will never become a diamond, no matter how long you wait. That's the truth. But forget the truth. Coal is famous for becoming diamond. Mr. McDonald had a moment in the mid-90s when he was a diamond, and I watched him on TV and thought he shone brilliantly and had facets. But it was a lie, and we were all fooled. Mr. McDonald was and is a sad, misshapen, crumbling chunk of the blackest coal. Before I can walk once again in the sunshine of New York as an important author, before I am seen as the diamond I always have been, I must finish this damnable memoir. I must find Mr. McDonald's essence, and to that end, I must become him. I have begun donning his preposterous wardrobe. Now when I look in the mirror, instead of seeing a fashionable New York gentleman, I see a costumed clown, a slovenly mess, each piece of clothing an advertisement for McDonald's past success. Twice when I have ventured out in the street with the costume, I have nearly been mistaken for him. I can see how people see me and search their memories for my name but are unable to bring it to their lips. A few times people have thought they went to school with me. I have been poring through all the tapes he's given me, dozens of TV shows and movies I never realized he'd done, and each one is worse than the last. I'm captivated by the boxes of videotapes of Mr. McDonald doing stand-up, stretching from 30 years ago to the present. The tapes are fascinating only in that they each contain the exact same stand-up material, word for word. And finally, I've been reviewing all the tape recordings of me interviewing him. On them, he often flares up with anger and shouts things like, "I'm giving you gold, Keen, gold, I tell you!" And I think, you have given me straw and a Rumpelstiltskinian task. A few weeks ago, Mr. McDonald called me from Las Vegas and told me a story of meeting Andy Griffith at an airport, and he insisted that the encounter be transcribed word for word. I have never done such a thing. To let a celebrity's words unvarnished touch the page goes against every instinct I have as a ghostwriter. So after I hung up, I phoned Julie. She's the boss. To my surprise, Julie agreed wholeheartedly with Mr. McDonald, telling me that what she is looking for is authenticity. It must have been my imagination, but when she spoke, I swore I could hear the oaf grunting like a swine in the background. I do not consider myself a cruel man, but since it is out of my hands, I can't help but smile, knowing the reader will have to endure a small taste of what I have been force-fed a steady diet of for nearly a year now. A story by Norm MacDonald, word for word.